Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Regular listeners will know we love music here at On Point. Over the years, there have been many happy nights when we've taken a step back from the news and turned our ears and our hearts to some of the best musicians out there. Their songs and their personal stories bring the world to life and into focus in a way that sometimes only music can. We'll go on bringing music and musicians to you, but this week, in a special two-part summer series, we're listening back to some of the most interesting popular musicians who have performed for the On Point Studio. Yesterday, we heard from Cassandra Wilson, Michelle Schacht, Laurie McKenna, and Katie Lang. Tonight, we'll hear from the guys and the world of rock and roll, from John Mellencamp, Ry Cooder, Los Lobos, Lou Reed, and Wilco. Up first tonight, from a conversation in July 2003, John Mellencamp. First hitting it big in the 80s with rock anthems like Ain't That America and Jack and Diane, the Indiana-born Mellencamp was the rough-and-ready John Cougar back then. He's recorded more than 20 albums, sold 40 million records, and launched 29 singles into the top 40. We caught up with an older, wiser, but still a little wild John Mellencamp after the release of his album Trouble No More. He'd put down his boot-stomping arena lyrics for this record and instead picked up a trail that took him deep into the blues-tinged heart of American roots music. Here he is, singing a track from Trouble No More, John Mellencamp with Teardrops Will Fall. Teardrops Will Fall from John Mellencamp's new album, Trouble No More. John Mellencamp, you take a lot of trips on this album in the Mississippi, into the Mississippi Delta and all over. This one, both with that sort of vintage Mellencamp top and even the lyrics seem the closest to what we think of as John Mellencamp. How did you choose this song for the album?
Well, I grew up listening to this song. I mean, it was my dad's only 20 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So he was a young guy, a kid having kids, basically. And, you know, he had music around the house, and I just remember this song, you know. So when we started messing with it, started, you know, playing it and rehearsing it, it just started taking on the traditional, what, you know, everybody thinks would I should sound like. So in a way, when we were doing it, I thought it was kind of good because it kind of just showed the listener that there wasn't that much of a leap from what I've been doing to what my heritage in the music really is.
Mm. The linkage is strong. It comes right down. You can hear it in this kind of barroom rocker here. You've been quoted saying that blues has been picked up and essentially, you said, methodically ruined by white guys over the years, that you yourself, when you were a young man, didn't even realize the debt, and more than the debt, the kind of direct taking of so many songs of the early rockers that came right out of black blues.
Right.
Did you have any idea? And what's the ruination you're talking about there?
Well, you know, the early English artists like the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds, those people in Cream, those English guys were really into American blues, and a lot of the material that they did, you know, like the Stones' first four albums, I think they only wrote two or three songs on the whole, but they did such a wonderful job on it that, you know, we all thought that they had written those songs because here it was our music in our, you know, in our house, and it took these guys to bring it to us. What happened, I think, over time, and I'm talking about the ruination of it, is that people just, you know, got lazy with it and just boiled it down to 16-bar boogie. Dun to dun to dun to dun to dun to dun to dun. Okay, we've heard that.
Yes, we
have.
Know,
we've heard that, and I don't want to ever hear it again. And, you know, I could have done every song on this record probably in that fashion. And it's kind of the lazy, easy way out, you know, to play the blues. But if you listen to Robert Johnson, you listen to Son House, those notes are being performed in those songs.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other things going on around it, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can go into any town in America tonight, and you're going to find guys doing this material. And it's just not very good. And so, you know, for a while, you know, I would tell people, I don't even want to hear a blues song. Don't even play me anything because, you know. It's just too derivative of itself.
But John Mellencamp, I want to turn to this album for just a minute. There's a song on here called To Washington. It's the only song that's got your moniker behind it as the author of the verse anyway, but the song has a real history. Take us back to the roots of this song.
I think the song was originally written in like 1903, something like that, and been recorded by a lot of different artists, the North Carolina Ramblers and the Carter Family and Woody Guthrie. And the tradition of the song is that everybody rewrote the song and made it part of the time that they were living. And the other thing that I thought was funny and ironic was they all said they wrote it. So
right.
I thought, well, if I'm going to record the song, I have got to put my spin on it, and I've got to bring it up to date and make it political about our times. So really all I did was just look in the newspaper and watch the news, and everything in that song was pretty much being reported as I wrote it.
John, if you'll permit us, let's get the little then and now feeling here. Here's the Carter family with what they called the Cannonball, but it's the same, To Washington. This is way back, the Carter family with the tune. Then we'll hear John Mellencamp.
You can wash my jumper, starch my overhaul, catch a train they call the Cannonball from Buffalo to Washington. Yonder comes a train coming down the track to carry me away, but ain't gonna carry me back, my honey babe, my blue-eyed babe.
When you sat down to write this song, John Mellencamp, to update the lyrics for your time, our time, we had a recent and disputed election behind us, a new president in the White House, and a war going on.
Well, that's not true. The war wasn't going on. Matter of fact, when I wrote this song, there wasn't even much talk of us going to war. There was no talk of us leaving the UN. Because if there would have been, it would have been in the song.
Well, you got Baghdad in here somehow.
Well, there was talk of, you know, going in. You know, it was spread. It was the very beginning. Very beginning of the whole conversation of what eventually happened, you know, knowing what I knew and what I had read about Halliburton and all that kind of stuff, I just wrote what was in the news. And then when the people heard the song, you know, there was such a wonderful job of McCarthyism going on when the war started, and a lot of people, you know, called John Mellencamp, among others, an American, which I thought was laughable.
That's a pretty good stretch.
I've been here 25 years now. I also read on that list that Jimmy Carter was an American, and I thought, wow.
Okay.
You know, that's pretty good company.
Thought he was president.
And I thought after 25 years of making records, if you can still piss off the right, it's probably okay.
John Mellencamp singing To Washington from his 2003 album Trouble No More. There's much more to come in this special edition of On Point. After the break, Ry Cooder, Los Lobos, Lou Reed, and Wilco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but it's worse now since he came from Texas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're bringing you a special edition of On Point, listening back to some of our favorite popular musicians who've joined us to talk and play. By the time he was 18, Ry Cooder was already a star among studio musicians. He played with international talents like V.M. Bhatt and Ali Farka Touré. Then came the Cuban sensation, the Buena Vista Social Club, the most successful world music CD in history. The U.S. State Department didn't take kindly to Cooter's Cuban journey, but they did allow him one more visit after that album. From that came a partnership with Cuban guitar maestro Manuel Galban and the 2003 album Mambo Sinuendo. I sat down and talked with Ry Cooder just after the release of Mambo Sinuendo. I asked him what he thought fueled his musical wanderlust.
Well, it's a good question, I guess. When you're doing it, one doesn't say I see myself as a searcher or a pilgrim. Of course, you know, naturally, it's the clearest thought I might have ever had was I'm trying to learn to play guitar, and I'm trying to learn how to access, to use a kind of a fancy word, you know, certain emotions or certain experiences through the instrument, because it's the vehicle for seeing and the vehicle for awareness that I had in my hands. In other words, I wasn't a writer, I wasn't a painter, I wasn't a philosopher or whatever, you know. I didn't quite develop along those lines. A mathematician, perhaps, you know.
Yep.
So the instrument was this, like a surfboard or something, call it magic carpet, if you like, I don't know. When I was pretty young, I guess a teenage, right before around those session times, but I could see that records were proof that there was a world of information that it was hard to link up to if you lived in Santa Monica and all this, and it was just tough. So you had to really push your envelope, and then I began to meet people who were floating around and doing things, and I could see that this was the answer and a good way to live, and it seems to have been true, you know.
And thank God you took the path. Ry Cooder, I've been such a fan for so long, but to tell you the truth, I really, until preparing for this show, had never looked into the kind of biographical part of your life. I've known you through your music, and your music has been more important than I can say in my life. But now, I just dip into the river of information that's out there today, and I've learned so much. I mean, starting with this story of you as a young boy in Santa Monica, and the radio as a kind of connection between that youth and the Latin music that's come to so define the last half decade or so of your life and recording.
Right. Well, fortunately, in L.A. at that time, that's the 50s. They had so many groups were emerging here. The Southern people, the hillbillies, Arkies, Okies, come out to work in the defense industry, so mm-hmm. they had radio station for them, which was my favorite. Mm-hmm. This radio station was something else. I mean, it was Western Swing. You heard Merle Travis and Bob Wills, and you could hear Hank Snow singing, you know, Yellow Roses and all this stuff. I used to always say, I'm sick, I can't go to school, my throat hurts.
And they would and say, not okay. for the top 40 where you stayed.
And they'd go off to work, my parents, and I'd lay there in bed listening to this radio station. It was an experience I wish everybody could have now, and you can't have it.
It's going away.
And there was everything's gone. The black radio station was great. Because you had Jimmy Reed in those days. You had even Howlin' Wolf on that radio station in those days.
Yeah.
Regional radio and so forth. And then there were Mexican stations, of course.
And all of that pouring into the ears of the boy in Santa Monica.
And bowling. I used to like listen to bowling, broadcast from bowling alleys.
The for the percussion of the falling pins?
Yeah, the space.
The ball rolling.
The echo of the pins falling down. There he goes again. And I just thought, what a deal.
There he goes again.
Where is that?
I may be overextending, but I can hear some of that echoing, I don't know, garage or bowling alley mm-hmm. sound in some of the acoustics that you've got on your new album, Mambo Sinuendo.
Oh, sure.
Let's listen to a little something more from that. There was one cut that I really love, Bolero Sonambulo. Let's listen to Ry Cooder's new album, Mambo Sinuendo. Right. Tell us how you chose this song.
Oh, this song, it appeared during a break. You know, this is intensive work and it's tiring. So sometimes
this is recording in Havana.
In Havana with Galban, and you might like to get up and wander around, get a cup of coffee, mm-hmm. you know, and he goes in this case, sat down to the piano just to relax, starts playing this thing. And I watch him. I'm always watching him, you know, to make sure that I know what he's doing, and I can see that he's onto something. So I ran out. Grabbed Keltner, we ran out, just the two extra of us, and started playing with him. You can hear Keltner playing the most eccentric drum part in the world because he knows from experience, 30 years experience with me, you don't have time to think, just react and keep doing it. Don't stop.
It's laid back to the point of I don't know what.
Well, he's playing a part nobody would play, you know, intentionally. So then, of course, my thought is, and I know that the session dat's on, that is to say the recording, there is some recording technology that's working, so we have this going on. It's not hitting
the
air.
Keep it going, right.
Yeah, don't turn off. And then you have to hope that Galban doesn't get up from the piano because he's always wandering around. So he seemed to be into it, so we just kept playing and then, of course, cut the tape, and there's a nice, pretty tune.
How fabulous it was. And, of course, some of our listeners may not know Manuel Galban. He was from one of Cuba's most popular groups in the 50s and just a tremendous guitar maestro there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, Los Zafiros were the most well-known and loved of the sort of so-called doo-wop vocal quartets that sprang up down in Havana, of course, only in Havana, not in the countryside, the city form, you know, borrowing or importing, hybridizing, whatever, from the American vocal group sound that they must have heard on the radio. They didn't have much access to outside music in those days.
But they picked it up, and wow, did they run with it.
They sure picked it up, yeah.
You, of course, went to Cuba for Buena Vista Social Club, a tremendous sensation. I hadn't known until boning up for this show that you ended up fined $100,000 for going down. Of course, that access has been difficult for many years, and ended up getting a special dispensation from Bill Clinton in one of his last days as president to go down and do this album, Mambo Sinuendo.
Yeah. This and the Ibrahim Ferrer second solo record. Well, sure, we had to do it. You had to do it. You know, it was obvious that it's a good idea, and you couldn't exactly just sit there and wait for everybody to drift off or for the moment to evaporate, you know what I mean?
Because this is music that is expiring if you don't grab it. I mean, these musicians are old.
Well, plus the consciousness of it is transpiring. Yeah. There's no more, even now to this day, right now, this moment, I wouldn't have wanted to have to do this. We did this in 2001. I wouldn't have wanted to try it in 2002. Hip-hop has already altered the course of consciousness in Cuba quite a lot.
Recruiter, I want to do a tremendous backflip here. And if you'll indulge me, go back to a night in 1972. I was with some friends at a house out by Tick's Junkyard. They were a bunch of musician friends of mine. I had rented a house there, and it was a summer night. I opened the front door. I walked up on the porch and said, "You've got to listen to this." And coming off the stereo was Boomer Story, your third album, I guess.
A house in a junkyard?
Well, it was next to the junkyard fence.
That sounds good. I like that.
Oh, boy. Let's listen to just...
I like junkyard.
We can hear it in this album for sure. Let's go back. And here's where I hook in, Rye. I'm sorry. This is personal, but this goes way back with me. Let's listen to a little bit. Boomer Story from a CD of the same name from Rykooter 1972. Rykooter's 1972 classic Boomer Story. He spoke with us in 2003. We caught up with Cooter again just last month following the release of his latest album, Chavez Ravine. To hear both interviews in their entirety, go to our website, onpointradio.org.
I never saw the gal again.
30 years ago, high school friends David Hidalgo, Luis Perez, Cesar Rosas, and Conrad Lozano came together to form the revolutionary Latin rock band Los Lobos. Saxophonist Steve Berlin joined a few years later. Last year, on their 30th anniversary, they recorded a new album called The Ride. And this time, some of their friends, including Elvis Costello, Bobby Womack, and Tom Waits, rode along with them. I spoke with David Hidalgo, Luis Perez, and Steve Berlin just after The Ride was released. But first, here's a track from The Ride, Elvis Costello singing the Los Lobos classic, Matter of Time.
Speak softly, don't wake the baby. Come and hold me once more before I have to. Just a matter of time.
Beautiful song. You guys really do get around. Elvis Costello in your crew on this album as well. I'm joined tonight by Luis Perez, Steve Berlin, and Dave Hidalgo of Los Lobos. Luis, I think you wrote this for your 1984 album, How Will the Wolf Survive?
Yeah, that's right. David and I wrote this one of those, now rare occasions where we were able to sit down and, you know, with the guitar and pencil and paper, we kind of communicate more by tape now.
Yeah.
But, this was written it was 84.
When you listen to it now, in this recording with Elvis Costello singing it, do you still feel the impulse that led you in the early 80s to write this? What was the impulse? What was moving you, and do you still feel it?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and Elvis just brought back all those impulses and those memories and emotions all over, you know, back. The song originally, we back in '84, David and I wrote it, was about an immigrant, about a man who's leaving his family to come across the border here to work in the U.S. For Mexico.
Yeah.
And Elvis heard this song and he incorporated it into his acoustic shows he was doing during the 80s, and the song actually became for me that this is a really important song on this record because of the kind of historical sort of thing, you know, that it's talking about the plight of the immigrant, which still exists, and also where we kind of find ourselves in that same place by traveling around the country the way we do.
Yeah.
and leaving our families. And so when Elvis did this, it just stripped down with the piano, it just made it all that more poignant for me.
It's a beautiful rendition of a really great song from the pens of you and Dave Hidalgo. You know, it raises an issue that I wanted to ask you all about. We're going to get geopolitical here for a moment, or just political maybe, but in the current Foreign Policy magazine, there is an article by Samuel Huntington. He's the big Harvard professor who wrote this book, The Clash of Civilizations, some years ago. Now he is writing about Mexican immigration. And in this distinguished journal, this distinguished professor says, many Mexican Americans simply do not appear to identify primarily with the United States. He goes on to say, this reality poses a fundamental question. Will the United States remain a country with a single national language in a core Anglo-Protestant culture? And you can kind of hear this in the way it's put here. But he raises this as a warning. Watch out about the future. This country may split up over immigration and an immigrant population. I just want to throw that out to you. What do you all make of that?
Too late. Yes.
It reminds me of the in Britain, the National Front, there's the same thing where there's a, what's his name, Enoch Light, I believe his name.
The kind of nationalist, white...
Nationalist, right-wing gadfly tries to, same issue, same agenda.
Enoch I think Powell, it's just, yeah.
Enoch Powell, yeah, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Enoch Light, he's a composer. Yeah, Enoch Powell. You know, it's racism. Any, you know, it doesn't matter how many PhDs you have, it's racism.
But I want to dig in there a little bit further. It was, Louis, I think you, I heard you say there, it's too late. So has he got kernel of truth here? Or what's going on? Is it just time for the United States to reimagine itself?
It's beyond reimagining. It's a reality. And that's what has to be dealt with. We would travel around the United States. You know, we've been on the road for 20 years. And we see the face of America changing. We would be in Burlington, Vermont, or somewhere in Minneapolis, or somewhere in the Midwest, or Boise, Idaho, and then there wouldn't be a Mexican if your life depended on it.
Yeah.
But now they're, you know, we see Mexican Americans everywhere, and I'm just talking about Mexican Americans. As far as you know, Latin Americans from Central America and South America mm-hmm. are showing great numbers in major metropolises. But Mexican Americans, I mean, you're finding them everywhere.
So how do you think that's going to change this country, or how has it changed this country? Is he right that Mexican Americans don't identify primarily with the United States?
No.
Unicide? Because he doesn't watch the news and see the kids that are dying in Iraq. You know, I mean, there's a lot of Spanish surnames in there.
Sure
you know,
are.
I mean, a lot of different people. I mean, it's everyone, you know. If we didn't feel like we're Americans, what would we be over there? You know, I mean.
In this album, The Ride, and in our conversation tonight, there's a number of points at which you're all fairly critical of some directions in which the culture has gone, the music has gone, the politics have gone. What do you think the impact of Mexican Americans will be on this country's culture, its politics?
Straight down the toilet. You know? Louis, you take it, Louis.
Well, you know, we just by sheer demographics, you know, we're talking about upwards to 40 million Latins, and by the census of last year, Latin Americans outnumber Blacks or African Americans as of last year.
But how's it going to change, or how has it changed the country?
The food's going to be a lot spicier.
You can count on that.
Culturally, I think that there's still to be seen, because here we have what happened a few years back with what they called the Latin wave in music, which, I can't tell you how many times I fielded that question from journalists asking, how has this Latin wave affected your career? And I said, it hasn't at all.
Washed right over, thank you.
I said, yeah, I'm sorry, it hasn't affected us at all, because unfortunately what that does is it creates this kind of new standard. And suddenly, people define Latin music as congas and Ricky Martin.
Yeah.
That's not what it is. It sends us back a few steps, but we're just going to keep pushing forward, and let people know what exactly Latin music is. I think that's a responsibility as Los Lobos, so always try to redefine a lot of the stereotypes and myths that people have about our culture.
Louis Perez, David Hidalgo, and Steve Berlin of Los Lobos. They spoke with us just last year.
There's much more to come in this special edition of On Point. After the break, Lou Reed and Wilco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're bringing you a special edition of On Point, listening back to some of our favorite musicians who stopped by the On Point studio. Lou Reed made his mark in the rock world early, first as the leader of the breakthrough group The Velvet Underground. Then, as a solo performer, he got darker and darker with songs like Walk on the Wild Side, Sally Can't Dance, and Heroin. In 2003, Lou Reed matched his music to the even darker stories of American literary master Edgar Allan Poe. The result was the thoroughly modern gothic CD, The Raven. Poe's horrors are recited, sung, and interpreted by Reed and a slew of guests, including Willem Dafoe, jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman, and even Reed's wife, Laurie Anderson. I asked Lou Reed what sparked his passion for Edgar Allan Poe.
I hope people understand Edgar Allan Poe is not just a Roger Corman movie. Edgar Allan Poe is generally recognized as one of the greatest of America's writers. You have, let's see, Hawthorne, Melville, Poe.
The real towers,
Whitman,
the real geniuses.
When you're talking about the top, you have to have Poe in there.
And yet you write that he is more peculiarly attuned to our new century's heartbeat than he ever was to his own. What do you mean by that, Lou Reed?
What's your last name?
Ashbrook.
Well, Tom Ashbrook. What I mean...
Oh, boy.
What I mean is that the world the way it is today, I mean, now there's SARS, for God's sakes. It's not bad enough AIDS and terrorism and job security and anthrax and now SARS. There's ample reason to constantly be kind of looking over your shoulder and thinking, whoa, what could be happening?
What's that dark shadow?
That's Poland. What is that big dark bird coming sitting in my room?
Yeah.
That's my take on it.
Now,
this is a station that reaches a lot of colleges, so if you're out there and you have a differing opinion, I'd like to hear about it. My take on this is that, and the way I did it on the record, the CD, we have a vinyl version made in Germany that's, you know, I would give anything if the people who made... I'm not in charge of these things. The people who made CDs, fine. A CD's that big. It's like a 45.
Sure.
But package it the way you would have packaged an album.
So it's
past.
Got some presence.
A real package.
Yeah.
The real album. So, okay, so the CD's not as big as a record. Doesn't matter. Keep the package
Blow
that
up
big.
The package.
Get rid of that wretched plastic.
Yes.
That thing that busts in your hand. By the time you open it, it cracks and you feel like shooting it.
Edgar Allan Poe might have sliced his wrists with it. We're going to intersperse our conversation with tracks from Lou Reed's new CD, The Raven. Here's a dramatic reading of The Fall of the House of Usher. Lou Reed, you have Fisher Stevens and Willem Dafoe reading here.
And Usher's sister is played by the magnificent, magnificent Elizabeth Ashley, who's appearing on Broadway as we speak.
Pulled together by Lou Reed. Let's hear it.
And then I had a vision.
Ah, Edgar. Ah, Edgar, my dear friend Edgar.
It's been a long time, Roderick. I've ridden many miles. It's been a dull and soundless day for autumn. The leaves have lost their autumn glow, and the clouds seem oppressive with their drifting finery.
I know, my friend. Though I own so much of this land, I find the country insufferable. I deal only in half-pleasures.
Speaking of half-pleasure, would you care for a tincture of opium?
Nothing would please me more than to smoke with an old friend. I've experienced the hideous dropping of the veil, the bitter lapse into common life, unredeemed dreariness of thought. I have an iciness, a sickening of the heart.
It's true, you don't look well, Roderick, but I am your friend, no matter the occasion or position of the stars. I'm glad you wrote me, but I must admit to concern.
I cannot contain my heart. Edgar, I look to you for solace, for relief from myself. What I have is constitution, a family evil, a nervous affection that must surely pass, but I do have this morbid acuteness of senses. I can eat only the most insipid food, clothes only of the lightest texture. The odor of flowers I find oppressive. My eyes cannot bear even the faintest light. Did you hear that?
I hear.
Dramatic reading from The Fall of the House of Usher, Edgar Allan Poe.
You don't sound as good as Willem.
No, not near.
By the way, do you
never
know,
have, never will.
Yeah. We were talking to some people. He said, Willem's voice is like an ice cream cone. And it's like just a huge bar of chocolate ice cream. You don't even have to know what he's saying. You just, that voice.
Oh, yeah.
So hypnotic and mesmeric. You like it so much.
It's somehow akin to yours, Lou. I can't put my finger on how to describe that kinship.
Well, that's a nice thing to hear. I don't know what Willem would think, but he's in a thing called the Wooster Group. And I met Willem through the Wooster Group, which is a theater ensemble in New York. And that's how we got to Steve Buscemi, because he had worked with Willem. And Katie Volk is also from the Wooster Group.
Now, when you pulled these lyrics up from Poe and into Lou Reed land, you actually came in and put some of your edits in here, some of your contemporizing changes to Poe. Did we hear some right here in The Fall of the House of Usher?
Yeah, I'm trying to make him more understandable. I thought, I understood him.
The kindred spirit.
I, more than any other human being.
Alive today.
I know Poe better than you do, and now you listen to me. His language is very difficult, can be very difficult. I, like I said, sat with a dictionary looking up all these different words and sort of references, etc., and then tried to put it into a way that would be understandable to you and keep things moving forward without having to stop and say, what does that mean?
You know that unbelievable feeling in life when you find someone who's searching along the same vein that you are, for whatever it is you're searching for, when you can feel their kind of comradeship in their search. And I'm assuming that's what you have felt with Poe.
Well, I think that's what great art is. I feel that way when I look at a painting by Vincent van Gogh. I feel that way when I'm reading William Burroughs. Great artists make you feel that way. That's what defines their universality.
Lou Reed, talking about his CD homage to Edgar Allan Poe. He joined us at On Point in 2003.
These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. Not exactly the boy next door. Tell you tales of heart and help play with your mind. If you haven't heard of them, you must be dead or blind. These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. Not exactly the boy next door.
The Chicago-based rock group Wilco set the music world on its head back in 2002. Reprise, their old record label, thought their latest album was junk. So Wilco picked up, moved on, and posted Yankee Hotel Foxtrot on the internet. It was a visionary move. The free songs led to a sold-out 30-city tour that was so successful that their new label, Nonesuch, bought the album, reportedly at three times the original asking price. Since then, Wilco has irreverently followed its own way. Since then, they've come out with A Ghost Is Born. Wilco lead singer and guitarist Jeff Tweedy, bassist John Stirrut, musician Leroy Bach, and drummer Glenn Kochi brought their instruments into the On Point studio back in May 2002. Memories of 9/11 were still heavy in the air. I asked Wilco how they characterized the band and their music.
Oh, I think that our only goal is really to not characterize ourselves. I mean, I don't think we really look at ourselves that way and try and figure it out. I think that's just a really hard thing to do. It's something that other people do, and I appreciate it, but I don't know how we really do it.
Let's let our listeners get a sense for themselves. I think you can play War and War for us there.
Yeah, this is some garage rock art splendor for you.
Right. You know, I tucked into the album and really came to like it. This has got a lyric in it, and this, of course, was before 9/11, before the war on terrorism, which we've talked a lot about here. But it's got a lyric that stands up awfully well after. It says, there's a war on, you're going to lose, you have to lose, you have to learn how to die if you want to be alive. Wilco, War on War. With their new song, War on War, from their new album, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. David Frick of Rolling Stone describes the album as earthy, moving psychedelia, 11 iridescent country songs about surviving a blown mind and a broken heart. You're talking about war in this song, and it's a long time before the war that we've got in our laps now was on. What was the moving inspiration when you sat down to work out the songs for this album?
I think that lyric is closer related to like a lot of perennial philosophy, like Eastern stuff and Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's not anything new. It's really war on struggle and really like trying to be satisfied and content in your life and not necessarily happy, but actively participating in life.
I get the loud and clear signal that you're not so into interpreting. But
I'm sorry,
America's right at the center of this album. At least it's been interpreted that way.
Well,
did you set out to write an album about America?
I was interested in writing songs about America because I thought that it was a kind of a dangerous thing to do, and it was really internal. It's not any big, broad statements about America. Mm-hmm. Just as kind of an exercise to try and write about what's really in front of me and whether or not it is America or if the cash machine is inherently evil or if, I don't know. It's really mm-hmm. trying to look at microscopic things, you know.
And you do it so well. Give us a sense of your background as a band. Where have you all come from? What brought you together?
Well, I came from a band called Uncle Tupelo, mm-hmm. I guess. That was my first band.
And Uncle Tupelo, was a kind of rock or country rock, or what was the sound?
Well, I think we were trying to be like an indie rock band. We were trying to play punk rock, and we were also really interested in folk music, but I think we really were trying to be as good as Husker Du and Dinosaur Jr. Like I think the bands early when we started, that we were aspiring to be as good as something like that, not necessarily sound like them, but those were the records we were probably as inspired by as the folk and country stuff.
And John Stirrett, what brought you in?
I was in a band that played around maybe similar type of kind of country, slightly country influenced indie rock, or maybe what was called underground at the time, the mid to late 80s, and met Jeff and ended up on the last Uncle Tupelo record and started Wilco right after that.
There's a sense in the way, I guess maybe it comes from the way this album was received by Reprise, that you all are now positioned as rebels in the music system. Is that the way you see yourselves? Do you have to be rebels these days to write and play the way you'd like to?
No way. No. A lot of people do it. I mean, I don't think we ever meant to be a cause célèbre for any sort of artistic empowerment or freedom. I mean, it's happening.
We feel like we just everywhere. Do what you're supposed to do, you know? We don't feel like if there's anything really noble in not changing your record. You're right. Really not supposed to.
No heroes, no villains in the story.
Jeff Tweedy, John Stirrott, Leroy Bach, and Glenn Cacci are the Chicago rock band Wilco. They spoke with us in 2002.
All my lives are always wishes. I know I would die if I could come back new.
For more on all of the musicians you heard tonight, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Angel Coselli, Matt Lieber, Persephone Meal, Mary Moore, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
A fresh wind and bright skies to enjoy my suffering. A hole without a key to break my tongue. Speaking of tomorrow, how will it ever come? All my lives are always wishes. I know I would die if I could come back new. My hands and knees every time the doorbell rings. I shake like a toothache when I hear myself sing.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.